8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. It's too friggin' hot.
Oh, I'm
already.
Not. Hey, I'm not hearing Maria on her mic at all. Do you got something on the...
Say something again, Maria.
Can you hear it now?
No, I'm not hearing you either.
You're going to have to switch then.
All right, let's switch over to the other side, and we'll...
blah, blah, blah.
Do some filler.
Ding, 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 ding. Oh, sorry.
Can you hear over here?
I can hear you now. Okay.
Much better.
So I don't know what was going on with that.
That's
but,
good. We'll use this one.
Somebody's head is going to roll about an hour from now. So good morning to you both. We have a ton to cover this week. So
it was a heck of a week.
It was. They were really trying to slip a lot by us. So
or just shoot at us. I mean, that happened too.
It does, but more so if you're in another country. So let's dive into it. Appears that it's getting a little warmer for Mr. Blair and our own administration from this whole media discovery of the weapons of mass destruction or lack thereof.
Well, the media haven't discovered any weapons, but they've stopped trying to discover them, and instead they've started trying to discover why they haven't discovered them, which it's been interesting. It's a full-blown political scandal over there that, as with the run-up to the war, is now threatening the Blair administration, with much of the outrage coming from Blair's own party. Has not gotten anywhere near that level of outrage from Democrats. In fact, it's been much more media-driven than driven by the opposition of the Democrats in this country, which is very, very interesting. But the other interesting thing, and the question that is not being asked in media coverage, is why is this a story now? Because, for example, the report of the Defense Intelligence Agency and some of the other things being hyped that are now out in the news, this was all out there and well known. In fact, we talked about it on this program and station every single week for about 6 months leading up to the war. It was all out there. It was all out there for network TV and the major dailies to trumpet across the front pages and try and stoke into a political scandal, but they didn't do it. And now that the invasion cannot possibly be undone, now they're coming to discover this. And so the question that needs to be asked, and we'll maybe get to that when we talk about the FCC ruling, is why is not so much what did the Bush administration do, but why did the media not seize on the information that was out there?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we had talked about it on the show, basically saying that if this is the best evidence that the Bush administration and the Blair government can produce for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, then it's a joke. There's nothing there.
And even beyond that, that much of the information that they were produced was either preposterous or fabricated, and we talked about that.
Exactly, and now we have evidence of that. There's a report that's been circulated among NATO allies called the Waldorf report. It's actually meeting minutes of a meeting between the UK Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and Colin Powell, where they both sit down right before Powell's presentation to the UN, and they both kind of shake their heads over the flimsy evidence that their governments have for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And it's not simply that they were saying, oh, we wish we had the absolute smoking gun. They're basically saying that the evidence was based on a lot of conjecture and not much else. That's what they were saying then. And we have the evidence now. But what I want to know is how come the media didn't look at the evidence then? Because the evidence then that was presented appeared extremely flimsy and just pretty much a joke. And
yeah,
we covered that on the show, and I covered it in print at the time.
Yeah, and again, there were additionally a number of instances, Powell's presentation at the UN being the most famous example, where the books were simply cooked, and that came out again before a war was launched. And then you have also the backpedaling of the White House in terms of what Bush is saying now about the weapons of mass destruction, and that is simply preposterous, and nobody's acknowledging that.
Yeah, Bush's main excuse has been, well, it's a big country, we'll find the weapons eventually. Well, now, come on, I mean, open up an atlas and look at a world map. Okay, Iraq is not a big country. It's not even really a medium-sized country.
Iraq, in fact, is about the size of the state of Montana, which, you know, Montana is a big state, but that's a little bit different from saying it's a big country.
Yeah, it's about a quarter of the size of Saudi Arabia, for example. Afghanistan is 50% larger than Iraq. Iran is three times larger than Iraq. South Africa is more than double the size, so is Pakistan. India is a whopping 6 to 7 times larger. Now, I mention all of those nations, particularly South Africa, Pakistan, and India, because they all have nuclear weapons program, have or had nuclear weapons programs. In the case of South Africa, again, is double the size of Iraq. The apartheid government had a nuclear weapons program and a chemical and biological weapons programs that they kept hidden during years and years of sanctions, just like Saddam Hussein. Now, when the apartheid government fell, those programs were immediately discovered. Now, it took a year or two for some of the chemical and biological weapons stuff to come out, but the nuclear weapons program was immediately discovered. There was no hiding it once the government had fallen. Laboratories, people who had worked in the program, just boatloads of documents. There was so much evidence that the UN had a hard time putting it all under seal so that it wouldn't go abroad to other nations. So you look at the contrast between the two. There are a lot of similarities, but in the case of South Africa, a country twice the size of Iraq, the programs were discovered almost immediately, whereas here in Iraq, it's pretty obvious that there was nothing there.
And again, with India and Pakistan, before their tests brought their programs out into the open in 1998, they had nuclear weapons programs for a couple decades, and the information on those programs was always pretty widely known in the intelligence community. It was pretty clearly collaborated when the programs came out of the open that information had in fact been accurate, that the facilities were exactly where people thought they were. And those countries are far larger than Iraq is.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Pakistan's twice the size. India is 6 to 7 times the size of Iraq.
All right. Moving along, wasn't a big surprise. The FCC on Monday relaxed those incredibly binding restrictions on newspapers and TV stations.
Yeah, the FCC now is moving on to the actual rulemaking, which is to say drafting the specific regulations for things like defining small business, since it will for those corporations that do exceed the fairly minimal limits on the number of stations it can own in one city or overall number. Sometimes when they buy smaller chains, they have to spin off a handful of the stations in a city because, say, Seattle, you can only own 8 stations, and they would now own 11. Well, in the past, the FCC has given preference to women and minorities. Well, that is, again, one of the areas that was taken out in the deregulation that didn't get quite as much attention. It's now weight is given to small business instead. Well, how is small business defined? Is it defined as something that's only, 200 and below in the Fortune 500? Or, so there are still plenty of ways in the specific, the devil is in the details level of this that the FCC can do damage. There's also a movement in Congress to take a look at that. A number of Democrats that have expressed concern over the ruling on Monday, but those are almost entirely Democrats. The communications committee, the committees with oversight in the House and Senate, obviously are both controlled by Republicans. Unless you have a change in the White House next year, add that as list 25,000 of why that change would be a very good idea. That's not going to go anywhere. So really, at this point, as soon as that rulemaking is in process, all the gloves are off, and that extended to a number of different facets that did not get very much coverage.
All right. Well, sticking with national news, we had talked previously about impacts of tax cuts, and there was some more finagling this last week over that. At the national level,
we're gesturing back and forth on that. The headlines this week were really kind of misleading, talking about the Senate looking at restoring some of the the tax, you know, the tax credits that were taken out at the very last moment during the during the negotiations for the passage of the bill. But the problem is that those restorations of tax credits are not going to be signed off on by the House. So, you know, again, it's kind of a way for the headlines to look like, oh, this isn't as bad as it actually appeared to be. But in fact, it's going to stand. The other thing that has come out is that we're finding that there were a number of details that that were either changed or added or deleted in those in that last minute compromise bill that didn't. That didn't not only didn't get any attention, but that many lawmakers didn't even realize had taken place. And there is, for example, a very good article that's up on the WorkingForChange.com website talking about. I didn't bring his name in front of me, but the guy from Georgia, Miller, who had a deal
Sel
with the,
Miller.
Sel Miller, yeah, who had a had a deal with the Bush administration to have a particular credit in there, and they reneged on him, which is, has been a pattern with the Bush administration of keep the cards very close to the chest, you know, try and get compromises from the Democrats and not make any compromises yourself. And we're just starting to get the details leaking out on that, on how bad and how destructive this tax cut proposal is.
All right. Anything else on the national one? Okay, let's talk about...
We're just trying to rip right through all these.
Yeah.
Well, here in the state of Washington, they're doing similar things, dealing with proposing tax cuts for one of our favorite companies, Boeing.
Well, I also want to talk a little bit about the state budget that passed.
Okay.
And not just tax cuts, but subsidies as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The state budget passed the House and Senate this week, just in the nick of time, because Monday the new revenue forecast would be released Monday, June 9th, and that would mean they would have to start all over again if the revenue forecast for the next year was lower than expected. But they got the budget passed, and Gary Locke is going to sign it, and I just want to go through what that new budget means. It means cutting over 1,100 state jobs, no cost of living increase for state employees, and it will raise their medical co-payments and insurance payments. It only partly funds voter-mandated pay raises for teachers, and then only for new teachers. It cuts funding to higher education, but gives colleges the okay to raise tuition by 14% over the next 2 years. It only partially funds voter-mandated pay raises for home health care workers who actually survive on less than $8 an hour. They had negotiated a contract for a $2 an hour increase. The legislature is only giving them 75 cents an hour, and in the process, the legislature is ignoring the first contract of this new, for this new union of home health care workers, which sets a terrible precedent for organizing state employees. The budget forces children in low-income families to pay premiums and co-payments for their health care. That could mean the loss of insurance for about 20,000 kids in Washington state, low-income children. And then there were, there were cuts in the basic health care plan that will affect about 30,000 adults. It also completely cuts out the medically indigent program, which pays hospitals a portion of their costs for treating low-income uninsured people, which means that those costs will get passed on to you and me, to everyone, in the form of higher health care costs at our state hospitals. So that's the damage that the budget does.
Yeah, and I wanted to circle back for a second to that revenue forecast that's coming out on Monday. It is universally expected that revenue forecast will show that the state is not bringing in as much money as anticipated as the budget is written that just passed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's kind of a common sense question of, well, if you know that you're not going to be bringing in this much money, why would you plan as though you were, even if the report hasn't been delivered to your desk yet that actually spells that out in detail? And the answer to that is not just that they would have to start over and it would open up a whole can of political worms, but the specific nature of the worms that would be in the can that was opened. In other words, there is would be very, very little political support for trying to close the additional gap that will be created by the additional shortfall in revenue by additional cuts in programs. The thing that will be threatened the most is Gary Locke's insistence on no major new revenue increases. That's what he's tried to hold to all through this budget process. That's why those cuts are so extreme. And it, you know, it's not just a question of not making additional cuts, but if you set the precedent of looking toward revenue as a way to close that gap, you also open up the question again of ameliorating some of those drastic cuts. That was also what was avoided by not going to the new revenue forecast. So, you know, even that isn't particularly good news in terms of the actions that Gary Locke and his Democratic enablers such as Frank Chopp also pursued.
And it sets up next year's legislature for reopening the whole budget process and looking at how they can fill the gap.
Yeah.
When they have to deal with much less revenue that's actually coming in the door than was projected with this 2-year budget that just passed.
Yeah, they're gonna be behind the eight ball again. The difficulty mm-hmm. at that point is that, you know, Gary Locke's going to be sitting pretty at that point, and you won't have had this continuous drumbeat for the past couple of months already on how awful these cuts have been. You're gonna have to be able to build up that political support for opposing further cuts all over again.
Well, and speaking of Gary Locke and Frank Chopp, it appears that they are looking at doing some other cuts with that affect unemployment insurance here in the state.
Yeah, and those cuts are basically for one employer to benefit one employer in the state of Washington, and that's Boeing. And unfortunately, those changes in the unemployment tax here in Washington, the way that that tax is collected and then the way that the benefits are administered, would actually cut a lot of low-income workers off the unemployment payrolls, particularly a lot of migrant workers and a lot of, for example, part-time college professors would be cut off the rolls, and a lot of low-income women who are single moms who are trying to work and can only work for short periods of time. So really, Gary Locke is offering these incentives for Boeing to build their 77 plant here, because this is one of the major things that Boeing has on its wish list for the state of Washington for us to get the 77 plant, is to change our unemployment taxes and how they're collected and how the benefits are distributed. And right now the legislature and Locke are trying to jump through the hoops. Now there's something else that's on that wish list that's not getting as much coverage that just came out, and that's tax breaks for Boeing. Now we're looking at less projected revenue coming in the next year or two, and here's the governor considering cutting taxes for Boeing so that it will put its 77 plant here. And he hasn't specified yet what tax cuts he wants the legislature to pass, but he's considering everything from sales tax, a break in the sales taxes. Boeing already gets a break on their fuel taxes, to a break in business and occupation taxes. Now, every company has to pay B&O taxes, and the fact that Boeing is getting this special break just tells you who Gary Locke is really working for. He's not working for us.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked on this program before in the context of the legislature trying to close this shortfall, that one of the things that was never ever put on the table for expenditures to cut or revenue to raise was the tremendous amount of corporate welfare that's embedded in the budget. And now, right
literally
at the moment,
hundreds of tax exemptions and tax breaks for businesses in the state,
adding up to hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars every year. And you know, that has never been put on the table. The biggest beneficiary of that, hands down, the biggest single beneficiary is Boeing. And, you know, none of these new additions to that laundry list of tax breaks and corporate welfare, none of these new additions to that Locke is proposing, and they hit in a wide variety of ways. They hit in taxes, they hit in capital expenditures, such as the proposal for Everett.
$16 million new port facility for Everett, which will be used mostly for Boeing.
Yeah, and all of the different ways in which Boeing is being catered to right now are not going to change Boeing's behavior vis-a-vis the state one iota. You know, Boeing is not claiming, and no independent industry analysis seriously expects, that Washington is even a serious finalist for the 787. It's very, very unlikely that it will come here. Future Boeing employment in the state is not going to be seriously affected by what Locke and the legislature do. Boeing's reasons for pulling out of the state are nothing that the state can really influence at this point. So it really boils down to basically to a gift. I mean, that's flat out what it is.
See, and that's what's fascinating to me. I'd love to see a study done on all the different municipalities across the U.S. that are currently trying to get that Boeing deal, and all the tax cuts and stuff that they're all tweaking, you know, as each one tries to, like, bring Boeing there.
Right.
That won't be switched back, you know, after Boeing says, nope, we're not interested. I mean, it must just be devastating if you added it all up.
Yeah, so all around the country.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So moving along, LEIU came to town this last week and had a different reception than Santa Claus might have gotten.
Yeah, it was
although
very
there
interesting.
There was some white in downtown Seattle on Monday night.
Yeah, there certainly was. Yeah, I had a very, very interesting week, actually. Toward the end of the week on Thursday morning, I got a chance, and I won't even describe how it came about to do an interview sitting down in the Red Lion with the general chair of LEIU, a man named Captain Richard Wright, who is in the Simi Valley, California Police Department. And if that town's name rings a bell, that's where Rodney King's attackers were acquitted a few years ago. So it's a fairly police-friendly jurisdiction. And there will be an article on that in the Weekly next week, and probably a much longer one in Eat the State. But one of the things that was very clear is that they had very little idea this was coming and had no idea what to make of it, because they've never gotten any attention like this before. The Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit does not see itself as anything other than just, you know, routinely doing business as usual. And the Seattle police and the city of Seattle, it became very clear as the week unfolded, were also doing business as usual. For folks who heard some of the testimony that was played in the 7:30 hour, the way Monday night unfolded was just absolutely unnecessary, absolutely uncalled for.
Now set the scene a little bit, Job. Monday night was the major protest against the LEIU.
Yeah, Monday night was the major protest against the LEIU. There were 500-600 people that marched from Westlake, the couple of blocks, over to the Red Lion. It was a fairly disorganized protest, and essentially it was the actions of a very small number, really only one protester, a guy who climbed up on an awning and tried to burn an American flag. That there were a number of other permutations, but that basically gave the police the pretext that they needed to attack and clear out the crowd. And they did so with a completely unnecessary use of force. They were firing live concussion grenades, you know, explosive charges into the crowd. We have video footage showing one of the police men there carrying an AR-15, which, for folks who don't know, that's essentially a machine gun.
Sprayed directly at people who were pretty peaceful.
Oh,
from the video
not just peaceful, but they were firing
not
just the pepper spray, although there were people who got doused from head to toe with that, but they were firing both wooden and rubber dowels, these little 2-inch projectiles that can raise huge welts,
and
at people who
do
were
serious damage at close range.
Yeah, absolutely. At close range, indiscriminately, at the backs of a crowd that was retreating. I mean, there was absolutely no threat to the police, and yet this was being done.
Yeah.
This
and when
is
I
all...
saw the videotape, my response was, we should just change the name of our city to Burma, USA.
Yeah, no, I was there. It was happening in front of me, and I got a good dousing of pepper spray myself, and the person that I was with, another weekly reporter, Philip Dowdy, got hit by one of the projectiles. But you know, beyond that, so they had all of this. You had really an unusual number, something that hasn't been that high, with the exception of WTO, at any Seattle protest, number of injuries, and serious injuries, people with broken limbs, people who had to be taken to, and in a couple cases admitted to hospital, including several legal observers, who the police knew they were there, knew they were not a threat, and they were still fired at close range. So you had all of this scenario, and then you had what unfolded in the next couple of days at City Hall, both with the mayor's office and the city council, where protesters who came to offer testimony, you know, the 7:30 segment was in the at a committee meeting chaired by Jim Compton, the public safety committee of the city council, where Compton was the only one there. There was no quorum. There was no way the committee could do its other business.
Pageler was there, and she walked
Pageler
out.
Pageler was there, and she walked out.
She
and there were
would
other
not
people.
Listen to the testimony.
No, and she's certainly done that before too. Yeah. That was her behavior after the WTO.
That's her modus operandi.
And you know, Compton didn't either. He was clearly completely uninterested, and he you know, he cut off the testimony, and there were various other facets to that. At the same time, protesters were prevented from leaving City Hall. The doors downstairs were locked and blocked off by bicycle cops, and both that and the following day, when protesters were there, the 12th floor, Nichols' offices, the mayor's offices, were locked down, so that there was no way ordinary citizens could hold either branch of our city government accountable. It really has become eminently clear that there is no serious oversight of the police department in this city. And when this is happening to, you know, relatively well-educated, relatively affluent, almost entirely white protesters who are not posing any kind of a threat to the police, I mean, this is really an indication of what non-white people living in parts of the city that are away from the media cameras, who are subjected to things like drug raids, whether they're the right house or not, the kind of violence and the kind of lack of accountability that they're living with every day. There is just no mechanism for holding these people accountable, because the only folks who legally can do so are in city council and the mayor's office, and they're not interested at all.
Well, people weren't actually on Wednesday were not prevented from leaving there. I was with that group.
Well, no, the people who had gone downstairs earlier actually were, and when the large group came downstairs,
right,
that's the point at which it was opened up again.
All right. Well, that's interesting that they wouldn't let them leave.
Yeah, it really is. It's
the other thing that I found intriguing was that Compton, he regularly does cut people short. He only gives them 30 minutes, you know. But this particular meeting, he opened with, "We have a short, light agenda today, but I'm still going to keep everybody reduced to, you know, to 30 minutes. And he eventually extended it to 45. But regardless of that, he wasn't saying that because we don't have enough time in the meeting to allow you guys to talk. Well, I was there at the meeting. I went out with the people, came back after everyone had been kicked out. Mm-hmm. And they were wrapping the meeting up at about 15 to 10 minutes of four. So they still had an hour and 10 minutes, if not an hour and a quarter, of free time where they're just like, you know, twiddling their thumbs when they could have been talking to these people that had come.
Or
you know,
listening. Yeah.
And these people that, you know, took time out of their jobs and stuff to come down and talk to city council.
And the other thing that and the audio really doesn't communicate is how utterly disinterested both Pageler when she was there and Compton for the entire time were in the testimony. I mean, he clearly wanted to be anywhere, everywhere, but listening to these people and could not care less what they had to say.
Yeah, and the only friendly ear we have on the council is Nick Licata when he opens up his meetings of the Parks and Recreations Committee by, you know, using some kind of justification like, well, this happened near a park, so let's bring these people in to do some public testimony. And he sits and he listens, actually. He's the only person on the council who cares, but he's not in a position to do anything about it.
Yeah,
the people who are do absolutely nothing.
And that raises, once again, we've got elections coming up this fall. We need people to run for those offices, both city council and things going down to, you know, Rita Butler-Wall and some other folks running for school board. But we need some of those other offices filled up with good, viable, progressive candidates.
Yes, and so City Hall was a busy place this week. Unfortunately, we don't have time to cover it all, but I will be airing tomorrow morning from 7 to 8 the excerpts from the Monday meeting dealing with the South Lake Union situation. So
people tune in for that. What time is that again?
That's from 7 to 8 a.m. All right. With that, we are pretty much out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Well, if you don't want the extremely abridged version of all of these stories, you can actually you can actually read some of the longer descriptions. Eat the State is a community newspaper that comes out every other week, free all over town at bookstores, cafes, places where you find things like that. It's also available on the web at www.eatthestate.org. We always need people to write for us, to offer feedback, critiques, story tips, to help distribute, raise money, all of the other things that that go with a largely volunteer operation. If you're interested, give us a call. Our voicemail number, area code 206-903-9461.